Good morning. Time now for the regular news roundup from the war fronts of the world. From San Francisco, we take you first to the Far East. Go ahead, China.
10 seconds to go. 5 seconds to go.
This is Harrison Foreman in Chongqing. It's exactly 7:01 in the evening.
Yes?
Friday evening. The Chinese coast is full of strong actions on that road.
Yes, it is.
The Roman general, for example, urges the United Nations to start offensive operations immediately to save the Pacific War situation from further deterioration. 3 points are emphasized for an effective large-scale counter-offensive. First, quick action is needed. Second, attacks should be directed against the islands of Japan proper to destroy the enemy's war industry and to smash the enemy's morale. And third, empty words should be averted. The China Times summarizes all three of these points by observing that the Allies raid on Mina Mitoka, a Japanese-mandated island about 1,200 miles from Tokyo, caused an air-raid alarm in Nippon capital. This should be ample proof of the Japanese fear of air attacks, concludes the paper. While air raids on Japan proper may begin with naval planes operating from aircraft carriers or Pacific island bases, heavier bombers will base more easily and more safely on secret airfields scattered about China. Moreover, an air offensive from China bases will be supported by land action on the part of Chinese fighting manpower, just aching for a chance for a well-supported counter-offensive against the Dutch. And so then, the Chinese are much pleased with the coming to China of the special mission headed by Lieutenant General Silver and Lieutenant Colonels Doan and Roberts, all three of whom, General Stilwell particularly, are recognized exponents of offensive warfare. One might speculate, perhaps, whether there might not be more design than coincidence in the call for offensive action in the press today. The only Chinese out here, these three, Colonel Doan, known affectionately as Pinky Doan, is one of the best-informed men on the Chinese army. Roberts gained fame with the sinking of the Panay. When the commander of the ship was wounded and incapacitated, Roberts took command and distinguished himself most creditably. Incidentally, that was probably one of the few times in American history when an army officer commanded a warship under fire. General Stilwell is the highest-ranking American officer in China. There is considerable hush-hush about his mission here. Though from his reputation in China in years gone by, both Chinese and Westerners have every confidence in his abilities and capabilities. He's a man of easy approach and amiability, given to no honors or ceremony. Of medium height, he has the toughest, most military bearing of any Westerner in China, with the possible exception of leather-faced Colonel Stanoff, commander of the famous Flying Tiger. He is a man of vast experience and knowledge of China and the Chinese. As military attaché here some years ago, he was not content to sit in an office and wait for information to come to him.
That was Harrison Foreman speaking from Chongqing, China. And now here is the latest news from the San Francisco newsroom. Netherlands and Allied troops fighting stubbornly against the Japanese hordes driving on Batavia, Bandung, and Surabaya drew back toward the hilly interior today for a last-ditch MacArthur defense of Java, pressing forward tirelessly and in overwhelming numbers through the driving tropical rain behind their tanks, their infiltrating light forces. The enemy imminently threatens Batavia, the capital, and Bandung, Netherlands East Indies High Command headquarters with pincers movements, and swung a strong force eastward for a direct attack on Surabaya, the great naval base at the eastern end of the island. Hope of immediate effective reinforcements has been abandoned by the Netherlands forces and the Americans, Britons, and Australians fighting beside them. But they have determined to fight to the last in strong points all over the island, and all combat leaders have orders to select and defend positions from which the fight might be continued, as the heroic men of General Douglas MacArthur have fought in the Bataan Peninsula. And now from San Francisco, we take you across the continent to the newsroom in New York.
Now, here in New York, a late dispatch from Moscow. Russian troops are drawing their noose ever tighter around that pocket of Nazi resistance between Rzhev and Vyazma, east of Nazi-occupied Smolensk. In the first smashing counter-drives toward Smolensk, the Red Army bypassed the fortified river town of Yukhnov, 120 miles southwest of Moscow. Now the Russians have cleaned up that sector. Now we take you across the Atlantic for the report of John McVane in London.
This is London. There's no confirmation in London yet of the Japanese claim to have taken Batavia, capital of Java. Reports reaching London from Mandalay say that the British have made the first tank attack of the Burma campaign against Japanese positions. It's authoritatively confirmed in London that the Japanese have cut the Burma road, but authoritative quarters here don't confirm the Japanese statement that they've taken Rangoon. The situation is said to be no worse than yesterday, but it's still very serious, and the British, outnumbered, are fighting stubbornly. As the Japanese increase their hold on Java, observers in Britain are watching closely for signs that may indicate the direction of the next Japanese move. Good sources here believe that the Japanese may not bother with an attempt to take Australia at once. According to this theory, they may secure enough bases around Australia to neutralize that continent, then turn into the Indian Ocean to try to join up with the German drive expected this spring in a huge pincer movement. If the Japanese do this, they may try to get Ceylon, bypass India, a part of it, and hit toward the Near East oil. This would drag out the Japanese lines of communication to an incredible distance. But to cut ourselves, the British and Russians, from the oil in that part of the world would be a smart protective move. These sources believe the Japanese won't try to attack Russia unless the German offensive seems sure of success. Because at the moment, the only point from which Japan itself can be attacked is Russian territory. The Japanese have built up a chain of communications and a flanking line of island bases to guard these communications, which would make a direct attempt by the American or British navies to attack Japan the next thing to sheer suicide. With nothing to gain except the psychological value of a raid, we'd risk losing our whole naval forces. Until the Russians feel secure enough to enter the fight against Japan, about all we can do is to try to attack Japanese communications and pry them loose from their bases one by one, building up our own bases at the same time. In the Atlantic, our position is thought to be very bad. And in the opinion of most observers here, the quicker we Americans realize what a tough spot we're really in, the quicker we'll start getting out of it. Because if we don't start the hard living that total war demands, if we try to cling to the peacetime luxuries with one hand and fight the war with the other, we may wake up one morning like France did and find that none of the things we believed in are there anymore. In front of me, I have the RAF pictures of the raid on the German-controlled factories near Paris. You may see some of them in your morning papers. RAF pilots flew as low as 400 feet, something less than half the height of the Empire State Building, to take these remarkable pictures. They show an area close packed with factories. You can see the effect of many direct hits, and you can see, too, where fires stripped the roofs off many of the factories. The raid seemed to have been confined to a comparatively small area. The Royal Air Force men had exact information on their targets before they left, and badly damaged buildings are stated to be engine shops, tank assembly shops, rolling mills, stores, an aircraft depot, administrative offices, repair shops, and foundries. In view of the Vichy statement about the factories producing only a few trucks, it's interesting to note that you can see at least 30-odd damaged tanks in the photographs. Direct hits blew off the roofs and left the tanks open to view. There's no telling how many more tanks are still hidden by the low roofs that remain. You can see 40-some trucks lined up along two streets and gaps in the lines where bombs hit. There are some apartment houses nestled in among the factories. They seem to have suffered from blast, as any house in the neighborhood of a direct hit is bound to suffer. But to those who have had experience of the London bombing, the Vichy claim of 600 dead and 1,000 injured must seem exaggerated unless the factories were working night shifts. The Renault workers, making tanks and engines for Germany, took their chances. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Next to our nation's capital, and the report of Claude Mahoney from the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. Bad news for automobile owners came from Leon Henderson, the price boss, yesterday. He told the Truman Committee that despite all possible curtailments, he didn't see where a single pound of new crude rubber was coming from for passenger car tires. He said flatly that it might become necessary to requisition the tires on civilian cars and put them on cars that are being used for defense purposes. That's the quickest way to bring the war home, I know. Take the tires from a present-day American, and you're really hitting him where it hurts. Henderson realizes the gravity of his suggestion. He says that taking tires from one man's car to give them to another is a social problem of a magnitude new to this country. You see, tires have become more than a convenience with us. They typify a way of life we've built up. They represent a whole system of transportation. Our entire habits are geared around automobile tires. Our homes are built where they are on the assumption that there would be tires on which to go back and forth. Take away our tires and we'll be as lost as the cowboy without his horse. Henderson has other ideas to save rubber. One is to cut speed to 40 miles per hour, a speed at which tests have shown the tires to last much longer. Another is governmental requisition of all scrap rubber, and other ideas that would force greater use of buses and railways instead of private automobiles. The rubber shortage is even tied up with the typewriter on which I wrote out these words a little while ago. Months ago, we were warned to protect the rubber platens on our typewriters. Frankly, at the time, even though I'd made my living on a typewriter for years, I didn't know what that rubber roller was called. But now, the War Production Board has gone farther than that. It stepped in and banned the sale of all typewriters, new and used, until a rationing system can be worked out. The new order even prohibits rental of typewriters. If you have a rented typewriter in your house now, you'll have to take it back by April the 1st. In the war economy we're building, there's no room for typewriter factories. They're needed for munitions and materials of war. Representative Carlson of Kansas has some interesting light to put on the tax situation. He made his own survey by mail and said yesterday that results showed the nation's workers are overwhelmingly opposed to payroll taxes or to increases in Social Security levies. On the other hand, employers are just as opposed to limiting profits to a point below 10%. His questionnaires were sent to 2,500 what he calls representative business firms throughout the nation, and their employees and stockholders. The answers were spread before the House Ways and Means Committee, which right now is trying to figure where to get $7,610,000,000 in victory taxes. The results of the survey were summarized this way. Employees are generally from 8-1 to as high as 10-1 against increasing Social Security taxes by 200%. They're about 99-1 against the proposed 15% withholding tax. And they stand 10-1 against raising Social Security taxes as a revenue measure. And it begins to look as though Congress is going to do something about the married soldier and the girl he left behind him. Senator Reynolds, chairman of the Military Affairs Committee, said legislation would be considered which would make compulsory payment of a part of soldiers and sailors' pay to their families, with the government also making contributions. And Senator Taft has a bill that provides for that system. Roughly, his bill would give a wife half of a private's army pay, or $10.50 a month, and then $30 from the government. A larger amount would be paid where there were children in the family, and the allotment would be greater if the bill passes to raise the pay of soldiers and sailors. And that's the news from Washington at this time.
And there you have the morning's news, ladies and gentlemen, as reported by John McVane from London, Claude Mahoney from Washington, Harrison Foreman from Chungking, and the newsrooms in San Francisco and New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.